Hi, everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering. We've got a packed show for you today. We've got three books, because we have musicals as well.
Yes, we do have musicals.
Yes, so I am Rob, and today I'm joined by the amazing, the wonderful Andrew.
A.K.A. Mr. Jazz Hands.
Yeah!
Nice. Should we do the entire show just in song?
No.
Good, that was the right answer.
Yes, and there will be no tap dancing either.
Well, thank goodness I didn't bring the right shoes first.
Yeah, neither did I. Anyway, we're going to move on to the news. So, Andrew, what has been happening in the world of the arts?
So, first up, we have a story from Russia.
Ooh.
And Vladimir Putin himself is putting out a new book.
Oh?
It's a book on judo.
Oh, well, he knows judo.
He does.
He's thrown bears about.
Yep. Tackled bears, not even wearing a shirt.
Yes.
I mean, they were probably like asleep bears.
Yes. So on the cover of this, is he riding an eagle or a Ritz cracker or something like that?
I don't know. I'm still waiting for him to be in like Baba Yaga's flying pot thing.
I don't know. He's got to be beaver in a fight first.
You mean the badger?
Badger, yeah. Not beaver.
No, that's a very different thing.
That's a whole different comic book right there. Anyway.
This is a book written by him, going to be co-authored and published by Arkady Rotenberg, who is an influential oligarch. I love the name of the book.
Oh?
Gentle Way. Gentle Way by Vladimir Putin.
And what age group is this aimed at?
It says school children. In theory, it's meant to like get children into forming athlete fighters and a harmonious personal upbringing.
And it's called Gentle Way?
Yes, by Vladimir Putin, who is, of course, the world's foremost proponent of the Gentle Way.
Yes. And the last thing that also you want to do is get a book from him about judo and give it to children, because you're basically raising the next in line to Putin. Seriously, there's Putin Mark 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and onwards.
But just imagine if it went the other way round, and Putin was eventually taken down by an army of judo-doing school children.
See, that'd be interesting.
Just like backflipping over the walls of his... I always assume he has like a castle or something. like on a cliffside with this perpetual lightning behind it.
I just had a very, very strange thought. You remember the old Weapon X project? Right, it was actually Weapon 10.
Yes.
Right, maybe this is a precursor, like the Russian version. They give out books first to see which ones actually can show an aptitude.
And it's Russian super soldier program.
Yeah, it's not the Weapon X program, it's the Weapon P program.
I mean, that's a bit less of a threatening name than Weapon X.
Yes, Weapon P for Putin.
P for Putdetta.
Do you think Putin drinks poutine?
We can only hope.
Because that would be amazing. Or if he started selling his own version of poutine.
What, Putin brand poutine?
Yes. It could work.
Putin it in ya.
Yes. Putin on the Ritz.
But we can't make fun, because he's an eighth dan in judo, Rob. And I'm sure he definitely earned that through years and years of hard work.
Well, to be honest, he actually loves judo, so I wouldn't actually be surprised if he didn't earn it through years of hard work.
It's a bit like, I can't trust a single fact that comes up. Maybe he doesn't even practice judo, maybe he just has his own body double where he hires, like, appear in all judo things.
The thing is, he says he's an eighth dan in judo, but judo has become so diluted. It's like karate and various other things. They've become so diluted now that the tradition of the higher ranked dans, it's very, very, very... I mean, let's put it this way. My brother is, sixth or seventh dan, Wadoryu. It's taken him years to get to that point. Right? Years. I mean, decades. Kendo, for example, you can only do the eighth dan test in Kendo, actually in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. That I was going to say, that Kendo is completely different.
But I've seen people who are like fifth, sixth dan in other martial arts. Well, hang on. You're younger than me. How are you a fifth or sixth dan? My brother is 48. And it's taken him since... He's been doing karate since he was about 9. and he's only a sixth dan now. So, you know, it's almost 40 years it's taken him to get to sixth dan. Do you see what I mean? Because the higher you go with the dans, the longer the time period is between you actually doing gradings to go up to the next dan grade. So for Putin to say he's an eighth dan, the main thing that makes me think that it's not true is his age. Because if he fails a dan grade, he has to wait to basically take it again.
Yeah, but that's what I mean, is that who's really going to fail him his dan grade?
I would.
Yeah, you also don't live in Russia, though.
And I'm also not a judo instructor of any sort.
That is also one of the key things, one of the key problems here.
So anyway, gentle way.
Just told on Putin, I need to compare your performance to the official judo record. Just shove Austin Powers on.
Oh, can you imagine if they treated it as they do whenever you go to work, for example? So you had key performance indicators, like KPIs. You have like everything broken down, the stats and charts. So here, your punch was several millimeters off the optimum. So I'm going to have to deduct points for that.
Well, you can chop this stone boulder in half, but can you punch this timesheet?
Yes, basically. So we're going to talk about your performance, kind of like a manager would. Then pointing out the manager apparently has no experience in judo, which is usual. I had to put up with this in call centres. I was dealing with people who were above me who actually had never done my job.
Oh, yeah, you would make a fantastic judo manager.
Yeah.
Just, Vlad, can you step into my office?
Yes. No, I'd be the guy from Office Space. You know, the really smug manager from Office Space.
Never actually seen Office Space.
Have you not?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you're missing out. You really got to watch it. It's amazingly good. And the guy is just, can you do that for me? Yeah. He's always got a cup of coffee as well as he's wandering around.
Yeah, I should watch Office Space. I mean, I've got plenty of time. And it's not like I accidentally bought like 8 DVDs yesterday. Help them, I have a problem.
Maybe you could get some gentle wear for it. So, moving on then. We're going to stay with Russia a little bit, but this time we're talking about a book that actually was novelized using Facebook. It was serialized on Facebook. And the reason why the author did that was to get around the censorship thing. The book is called Karlik, and it's getting an English translation. The author, Ole Shinkarenko, he began this as a series of Facebook posts to evade censors, and it tells the story of a man whose brain is controlled by the Russian army. The book is basically set in a Ukraine that has been taken over Russia, because that's never going to happen.
Nope, complete fiction.
Yes. And Ole Shinkarenko, he's a journalist and author, and he began writing his vision of an alternate reality in which Russia has conquered the Ukraine while protests were ongoing in Kiev. And we have like various extracts that are published from Index on Censorship, but the story grew out of a blog in 2010, and in it he joked about hoping there were radicals prepared to kill the then president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. Shinkarenko was subsequently interrogated by security services and found entries on his blog deleted, he believes, by the security services. He later turned to Facebook to tell his story of a post-apocalyptic future, echoing the violence of the Euromaidan protests in 2013 and 2014 in 100-word snippets.
That must have taken a lot of posts then.
Yes. But because Facebook isn't controlled by the Ukraine government...
They can't take it down.
Whereas your own personal blog is something that you don't really have control over, apparently.
Well, I guess it depends what you made the blog on.
Yeah. Yes, it does. So, yeah, that's an interesting thing. I mean, I've heard people publishing novels online, but I've not really heard of anybody doing anything like this, putting it onto Facebook in snippets, bite-sized chunks.
It's a really clever way to get around censorship laws.
Yeah. Well, we did see a rise in the number of people posting stories, new stories and stuff like that on Facebook around 2010, or late 2010 and onwards, didn't we?
Yeah, I guess that was kind of the point at which people said that's what Facebook could be for.
Yeah, because before that, people were putting stuff online, but they were mainly using their own websites or the BBC or some other news agencies' websites, stuff like that. They weren't really putting stuff on Facebook or anything.
Yeah, I guess maybe it's less to do with people wanting to use Facebook for that.
Yeah.
And more news organizations integrating themselves with Facebook a bit more.
That might actually be the reason, the increased integration with Facebook.
Yeah, I think that would make more sense, like just from their perspective, trying to reach a bigger audience.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense to me. So anyway, we're going to move on to what we've got next.
We have got Burpee Baldy and Deffy next.
A what?
Burpee Baldy and Deffy, who are all rejected dwarves from Snow White and the Seven Dwarves.
Burpee Baldy and Deffy.
Yeah. So really, this is, well, I guess we're staying within arts, technically. So this is a display of concept drawings by movie artist Albert Herter, who did the art for the Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And as we know, the final lineup was Doc, Grumpy, Happy, Sleepy, Bashful, Sneezy, and Dopey.
Yeah.
But apparently there were around 50 original ideas for the dwarves. And this kind of art display that's been sold at auction reveals some more of them. So among the rejected names, we have Jumpy, Deffy, Dizzy, Hickey, Wheezy, Baldy, Gabby, Nifty, Sniffy, Swift, Lazy, Puffy, Stuffy, Tubby, Shorty, and Burpee.
Really? Okay. So they didn't have any dwarves like Leggy or Handy?
No. And certainly not Busty.
I wasn't going with that. Handy, I thought, was a handyman.
No, Leggy, you didn't.
Yes.
No,
yes,
you didn't, Rob.
Yes, I did. Handy basically has like a tool belt. He's like Fix-It Felix. And Leggy, I just thought could run fast, you know, leg it.
I refuse to believe that was your intention.
It was. It totally was. I'm totally innocent. You're the culprit.
It'll never pin it on me.
Yes.
Oh, you can't, because I'm your alibi for the other thing we were talking about before the show.
Oh, yeah, true. Anyway. See, the thing that bugs me about Snow White and the Seven Dwarves was that... was it actually Seven Dwarves at the beginning? Or was it just Snow White and the Dwarves? I mean, the original story of Snow White.
Oh, no, apparently in the story, the Dwarves are anonymous.
Yeah. And how many of them were there?
I have no idea.
I think I'm going to have to check on this, because I'm curious. I think it was just Dwarves, as in just a group of Dwarves, and didn't actually say how many there were. No, Snow White, not Snow something else. That's
moving the story on to a very different direction.
Yeah, Snow White is the 19th century German fairy tale, which is known today widely across the Western world. Published in 1812 by the Grimm brothers. Magic mirrors, blah, blah, blah. Grimm with envy. Tiny cottage belonged to a group of seven dwarves. God.
Oh, so there were seven.
The Seven Dwarves is basically from the film.
I'm going to say eight in the original story. You had Doc, you had Grumpy, you had Happy, you had Sleepy, you had Bashful, you had Sneezy, you had Dopey. Of course, everyone's favourite, Tyrion.
Yes. Tyrion Lannister.
Yes.
As the leader of the Dwarves. And Lannister always pays his debts.
No. I've got it. It was Doc, Grumpy, Happy, Sleepy, Bashful, Sneezy, Dopey, and Whiny.
Yes.
Because that's Tyrion's main character trait.
No, he's more whino than whiny.
True, whino.
Yeah.
Boozy. Boozy the dwarf.
Boozy. Boozy is a good one. Did you see the honest trailer for Pixels?
Yes.
The bit where at the end when they're doing the character introductions and it gets to Peter Dinklage and says, Lannister must have needed to pay his debts. Yeah.
I think that's where, like, Cuba exploded and you just went, cubes.
Yes. Anyway. Yeah, there's some confusion about the dwarves. I think the fact that there were seven dwarves in the original Disney one has kind of coloured things now. And also the actual origins of the Snow White tale are very odd. I'll do more reading on this and I'll get back to you.
I mean, I assume being a Grimm's fairy tale, the original one ends with, like, Snow White flayed to the bone and hanging from the castle or something like that.
basically, the Queen is pointing to a pair of red hot iron shoes.
That's right, yeah, red hot iron shoes, and it's like, walk herself to death.
Yeah, and then she has to dance until she drops dead.
Hell was wrong with you Grimm brothers.
Well, when you get right down to it, the original fairy tales were quite brutal. It was all about blood and magic and stuff like that. There's several theories. Eckhart Sander put a theory forward in 1994 that Snow White was based on a person called Margareta von Waldeck, who was a German countess born to Philip IV in 1533. Another theory...
And she was just perpetually high all the time, and that's where the story comes from.
The other theory is that it was Maria Sophia von Ertal, who was born 15th of June 1729 in Lohr am Main, Bavaria. She was the daughter of 18th century landowner Prince Philip Christoph von Ertal and his wife. Neither of them mentioned dwarves.
Weird.
Yes. There are no dwarves in here.
Not even Wheezy.
Yes. Apparently, the first one, Margaret's father, owned several copper mines that employed children as quasi-slaves. But saying...
Well, that's taken a turn.
Yeah. But saying Snow White and the Seven Children... has a totally different meaning.
Snow White and the Seven Undernourished Child Labourers.
Yes. Or just Snow White and the Seven Children.
That's the council estate version.
Yeah, that's the council estate version. I was about to say Trailer Park Council Estate version. So, yeah.
No, in the Trailer Park version, she gets saved at the end by the Redneck Avengers.
Yes, yeah, she does. Redneck Avengers to the rescue. Cousin Bulk. We'll have to do that at some point.
Yeah. Just an entire lineup for the Redneck Avengers.
Yes. Yeah, Tony Stark becomes Papa Stark.
Of course, don't forget Billy Joel Quicksilver, fastest banjo player in the land.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Him and his banjo duels against himself. And the strange relationship between him and his sister, which is a real thing as well, because it happened in Marvel.
Well, you said not even that strange relationship.
And it did happen in Marvel as well.
It did. Oh, Jeff Loeb, you shouldn't have written Ultimate Comics.
No, no, he shouldn't. Anyway, shall we move on?
We shall. To our final story, which is the news that reporter Hill Lizziak has just signed a 4-book deal with one of the US's biggest publishing houses.
Okay, when you say reporter, okay.
Yeah, well, not just reporter. He's also the editor and publisher of Orange Street News.
Okay.
Which is the newspaper she makes herself because she's a 9-year-old girl.
What?
Yeah. She is a child who kind of shot to fame after breaking the news story of a murder case in her town in Pennsylvania earlier this year. I mean, she got there before the local newspapers did.
Seriously?
Yeah. Because she got a tip-off from the police, who she was talking to about the story of a vandal she was working on.
And they gave her a tip-off about a murder case?
Well, no, I think she got a tip-off about some commotion going on in that area.
Okay.
Probably did a recent but a full-length article on it.
At 9?
Yeah, at 9 years old.
Oh, my God.
And now her and her father, Matthew Lizziak, who is also a journalist... and it apparently got her into journalism, they are now working with Scholastic to publish a 4-book fiction series called Hill Cracks the Case.
Wow.
And she said that, I want kids who read these books to love reporting like I do.
See, it's cute and everything like that, but it also makes me a little bit envious, I'll admit.
I wish I was as cool as she was.
Yeah, I wish I was as cool as she was when I was nine. It's that simple.
I mean... if you want, you can maybe step in and be guest editor of Orange Street News, because she is apparently taking a week off to go to swim camp.
No. I have enough trouble as it is with thegeekshow.co.uk. Oh, anyway, Orange Street News can find somebody who is probably more well-suited. Besides, she's American, I'm English, she spells colour without the U, I spell it correctly with the U. Same with honour.
Sure. I mean, for once, though, I can accept it's okay. She's 9 years old. She doesn't know how to spell.
Yeah, that's fine. Her dad is a different matter.
We shouldn't say that, because she has got some criticism from people on Facebook being all, oh, she's too young to be running around doing these stories. She has just put out some YouTube beatdowns.
Oh?
It's mostly just her, like, reading out the comments on YouTube with just the most impassive, I do not give a damn face.
I think I'm going to have to look at this. I might cut some of the audio into this.
Oh, and like, one of the responses is, if you don't want me covering the news, you should get out there and do it yourself.
That's genius. I like that. Oh, why can't the BBC do that?
Because they are not run by 9-year-old girls, and clearly they need to be.
Yes. Yes. I think we have a candidate for the new Director General of the BBC.
Yes.
I think we have a definite candidate. Right, shall we take a break there?
I think we shall.
Right, we'll be back in a few moments with books. Plenty of books.
TV. There's a lot of TV. Even the internet is TV these days. And if there's too much out there to know what to watch and what not to watch, well, tune in to the Geek Show Podcast Network's very own TV show, On The Box.
And welcome back. We have returned to the show after a short break in which I certainly didn't get locked outside the office.
Yes. Yes, you didn't.
And now that we've accepted that as absolute fact, we're going to move on to what we've been reading.
Yes, starting with me. And I have been reading a book by Ren Warham, who is she's a new author, but apparently she's been writing since she was about 5 or 6. And this book is called Escapology.
Haven't we all really been writing since like we were 5 or 6?
Yes, but apparently she was writing plays and stuff like that when she was 5, 6. So, okay. This is Escapology by Ren Warham. Ren Warham is, I think it might actually just be a pen name. And this is published by Titan Books. This is a cyberpunk novel. I'll give you an idea of what it is. The world basically broke in a kind of 2012 John Cusack type scenario where the land fell, lands rose, seas distorted everything, and you have land ships who basically go around. They're like mega cities on water kind of thing. And one of these cities is called Fungong, and in that city lives a haunt or a hacker, a virtual world hacker called Shock Pow. Aside from sounding like
face when you said that,
yeah. Aside from sounding like sound effects from the 1960s version of Batman, Shock Pow has.
How dare you? Wham Kablow was very disappointed that you would dare suggest that.
No, I thought it was Wham Bam.
Wham Bam, thank you, ma'am.
No, it's just Wham Bam. Anyway, Shock Pow has a problem, right? Or rather, he has multiple problems. Number one, he thought he was going to be a big guy in the world of what's called the fails. Now, the fails are people who didn't really finish school and college and higher education and stuff like that, and they didn't get the cushy government jobs and all those things. They're basically neets, not in education, employment, or training, right? And Shock Pow thought he was going to be a big man amongst that particular underbelly of society. The only problem is it didn't work out like that. And he's now on the bad side of three of the larger criminal groups in Fungong. He has barely enough money to pay his rent, let alone buy food. And he continues to do jobs for his ex-girlfriend, Mimic, who has basically screwed him over repeatedly. He's just come out from 10 days in virtual reality trying to hack through something, and his body doesn't quite work the way he thinks it should, because for the past 10 days he's thought he's basically been in the body of a fish or something like that. So he's needing some kind of chemical treatment because, yes, he is a bit of a junkie as well. So Shock Pow has a lot of problems, but those problems are totally unrelated to me, so I find it difficult to actually relate to him as a character, because number one, I'm not a hacker and most people aren't hackers. Number two, I'm not a junkie and most people aren't junkies. And he's only really a junkie to try and balance him out. But I suppose in a certain respect, the whole influence of virtual reality, because there's a virtual world of this called Slip, and Slip has various things in it called hives. Each of these hives is run by a queen, which is like a semi-sentient AI type thing. I say semi-sentient because they still have controls in place to stop them going out of control. Now,
it's kind of like ED in Mass Effect 2.
Yeah, basically. Or a bit like Sharon Apple from Macross Plus, things like that. You know, it's an AI that's contained and is not allowed to go out of control. So, anyway, Shock has a new job. Mimic gives him a new job, his ex-girlfriend, that is. And
in between trying to steal all the X-Men's powers.
Yes, in between that. And he isn't happy about it, but he doesn't have much choice. Then it moves on to introduce a new character whose name is not 64. It's not Commodore, it's Amiga. Amiga works for Twist Calhoun, one of the toughest crime lords in the Gung. She is a cleaner. She's an assassin. And when you first see her, she is fighting a group of streaks who are basically high as kites and hooting and laughing and everything like that. And she basically takes them to town and snaps their heads and necks and stuff like that and slits their throats because she's a dyed-in-the-wool killer. This all cues up to Shock and Amiga meeting each other and then various things happening, and it goes all to hell, as it should. In any good story, it should all go to hell at least once, especially if it's a cyberpunk story. The problem with this is that it's very, very difficult to read. That's mainly because of the overuse of jargon, the overuse of terminology that isn't actually, you know, it's supposed to add to the atmosphere, but the way you add flavor to the atmosphere of a book isn't by overusing terminology, it's by using words that I can relate to or the reader can relate to more appropriately and flavoring it with that terminology so that you have more of a context. But if every other word in the sentence is jargon, then it becomes extremely difficult to develop any kind of context.
I mean, I guess it's kind of the flip side of that as you well know thing.
Yeah.
Where, like, they awkwardly have to explain in, this is the thing that we all know about, but we have to explain for readers.
Yes.
But this is the opposite of, you know, just throw things out there.
I've seen some people who've written their opinions about this book saying, oh, I like the fact that Renoir doesn't explain things. From my perspective, that's a bad thing with the regards to this. She does explain certain things, but there's a lot of other things that she doesn't explain that really need an explanation.
Yeah, like, there's a line between things you can fill in the gaps for yourself and things that you just won't understand what they are.
Well, this is why I talk about the jargon in particular. See, the problem with this book is that it seems like it's written partially as a look at me, I can do this kind of thing. And I hate to say that about any author, but it reads like that, right? I'm not saying the author has written it like that. I'm not saying that Renoir has written it like that, but that's how it reads. It reads like it's been written by somebody who wants the attention, who wants to show that they can do all of this stuff, that they have all these really inventive ideas. And I think it's just too much in one go. There's too much jargon. There's too many concepts being thrown at you about how this has changed and how this has changed. And there's too many things that conflict with everything else. It's not like peas on a drum. It's like somebody took the whole pea plantation, dried it out, put it on drums, and then went boom, and you have peas flying everywhere. So nothing bounces around and impacts and moves about in a nice kind of semi-organized way. You know, semi-organized, semi-chaotic. So you have that kind of naturalistic narrative going on. With this, it's all constructed chaos, but not the good kind of constructed chaos. Does that make sense?
It's a bit messy.
It's messy, but there's a structure behind it, and you can see the structure behind it, and you can see what Renoir is trying to do and the story that she's trying to tell. But the veneer of cyberpunk makes it look as though it pops and clicks, but it doesn't. The jargon is just too much. It really is just too much. When you can't refer to a monorail as a monorail and you call it a mono, and then the reader has to stop and go, well, what's a mono? Because they don't automatically think of a monorail.
To be fair, I mean, I think I probably would associate mono with monorail. But if this is in the same kind of book where a man hacks into a computer and imagines he's a fish...
Well, I mean,
It's not necessarily that you're going to be able to make that much of a logical connection between things.
Well, let's put it this way. The hackers are called haunts, right? But there is no explanation as to what a haunt is right at the beginning. You know, just says he's a haunt. And you're like, well, okay. The only reason I know a hacker is a haunt is because I read the back of the book.
Yeah, and that's what I mean, because this is a sci-fi book. A haunt could be literally anything.
Yeah, could be a ghost, could be a spirit, could be a... I mean, I've seen ghosts in the show, so haunt, to me, could mean something completely different, you know? And there's other things as well. He'd never been in slip for 10 days, so we don't know what kind of effect slip is. We don't know how real the virtual that virtual environment actually is. Do you see what I mean?
Also, it sounds dirty.
Yes, I know. He can apparently, when he gets out, just to read this verbatim, this is very first page of the book, he can't find his focus, his physicality. Keeps wondering why the bleep he has legs and can't swim. What this meat sack is with its tight skin and ever-present grind of hunger in the goddamn fuel tank, can barely think. His brain swelling like half-liquefied tofu in a bone box.
That's just a bit much for the first page.
That's what I mean. Too much jargon and overly descriptive when it comes to how people feel. One of the things that I find adds atmosphere to a world is where, as you said, you can infer certain things. But you have to allow the reader to infer them. If you cover it with jargon, then the reader spends more time thinking, what the hell does this word mean? Then, you know, why is this character feeling like that?
Yeah.
And that's the big problem with this book. In terms of its core concepts, in terms of the actual structure of the book, in terms of how it progresses, everything works. It's actually quite a good book under the surface. But the surface is this massive spiky jargon that you have to literally fight your way through. It's like, you know, Sleeping Beauty, right? The castle was covered in all those rose bushes and thorns, and then the Prince Charming had to cut his way through, and the thorns kept growing back. He had to keep fighting his way through to try and get to the princess so he could basically, we'll do the child-friendly version, give her a kiss and then get married happily ever after. Yeah, not the other version.
The version ends in Sleeping Beauty filling out a P-130 sexual harassment form.
Yes, basically. The language is like the thorns surrounding the castle. You have to fight it to try and make sense of what's going on so you can actually appreciate the story. And it's just too much. It's kind of unforgiving, and it does make you want to bash your head off a wall from time to time. But again, and I don't understand this. I've commented on this before. We've both commented on this before about the job of an editor, right? What is an editor's actual job? And to me, an editor's job is to try and bring balance to the writer, to basically allow the writer to tell their story, the story that they want, but also make that story something that the average reader can actually enjoy. I think that's the main job of an editor when it comes to publishing books. They have to take control. And it seems like with this, the editor's just been blinded by jargon and just gone, oh, yeah, if William Gibson can do it, then we can do it too, kind of thing. If Ian M. Banks can get away with all sorts of different language, then we can too. But it doesn't quite work that way. This reads more like it's aimed at people who think internet humor is good humor, or people who basically use internet memes as humor, and the rest of us sit there going, what the hell are you talking about? Ryan from Cinema Eclectica, he's guilty of internet humor. Half his jokes are internet humor, and you and I have both sat here on occasion and gone,
we have tried him and found him guilty of internet humor.
And this book reads like it's aimed at people who find that sort of stuff funny.
No, Rob, you have to do the pre-reading before you can hear the joke.
Yes. It doesn't seem like it's aimed at people who grew up with William Gibson as Cyberpunk. It seems more like it's aimed at people who grew up with The Matrix, or The Matrix trilogy, I should say.
The Matrix single film, Rob.
No. The Matrix trilogy.
There is no trilogy.
There is in the case of this book. Seems like it's aimed at people who grew up with The Matrix trilogy as their source of Cyberpunk. There are certain elements. The thing is, I read this and I get shades of 2012 meets a bit of Ghost in the Shell, meets a bit of The Matrix and various other things, right? And the thing that gets me about this is that I've read stories like this before. I've come across stories like this before. The whole idea of Slip and the AIs, the Hive Queens in Slip and various things like that. That, to me, is a plot element straight out of something like Summer Wars or Ghost in the Shell or something like that. There's other bits where the plot elements are straight out of other manga or anime or light novels I've read from the East. And it just seems like there's a mishmash of things going on. The structure of the story is solid. That's fine. The characters, unfortunately, I couldn't really relate to them. Because, number one, I'm not an assassin. Number two, I'm not a junkie or a hacker. You know?
So you were deliberately going out that Amazon review that talked about how relatable the characters are.
Well, it's not so much that. For you to enjoy a story, there has to be some kind of relatability to it. Some grounding factor. Some foundation that you can stand on so it gives you the perspective, gives you the context. And with this, I just felt like I was adrift all the time.
So I think what this is what a lot of people do is they mistake sympathetic and relatable.
Yeah, possibly I'm mistaking them, but...
Breaking Bad.
Yes.
Like, I can in no way relate to a 50-year-old chemistry teacher who has cancer, but I can still feel sympathetic for his situation, and that's what makes me love the character.
Yeah. Yeah. With this, though, unfortunately, I don't feel sympathetic for the characters. I can't relate to them in any way, and I don't feel sympathetic or empathetic towards them in any way. I look at them and I go, well, it's your own fault that you're in this situation in the first place, so I can't really sympathize or empathize with you. You made those decisions, so you have to live with them. And that is literally how I feel about the characters. You made those choices. Nobody else made them for you. You were a fully grown adult. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of... We're really just talking like a lot around the fact that they're unlikable.
Yes.
But that's cutting straight to the point.
It is cutting straight to the point.
It is hard to like them.
It is very hard to like them. And the thing is, they've got some redeeming qualities, but it's still hard to like them. The story isn't nonsense. And that, I think, is the key thing that I want to emphasize. The story isn't nonsense. There's actually a solid story there. But seriously, tone down the language. It doesn't need jargon. Or not that much jargon. Flavor the world with jargon. You know, flavor it. Give it some depth. Imagine a story is like food. You don't cover it in chili and cumin and turmeric and stuff like that and then expect somebody to actually enjoy it. You give it a little bit of chili, a little bit of turmeric, a little bit of cumin, a little bit of coriander, maybe a little dash of salt and pepper, right? The main body of the food, you know, say it's a piece of meat, a steak, lovely steak. You give it some seasoning. That's your flavor. You don't cover it in salt and pepper.
Ben Warren writes books like My Sister Eats Food, where she just grabs like a massive bottle of ketchup and just goes...
Basically,
yeah.
That's exactly it. I'm glad I finished on the food analogy because, you know, I'm me and food.
You do like your food.
My happiest situation is good book, good food, and me. That's my threesome right there.
Happy days.
Yes. Using the food analogy, it's a great piece of steak. It's a great bit of food. Really, really good bit of food. But it's just covered in too much of the seasoning, too much spice, too much of everything. So the actual food itself gets lost with all these conflicting mashes of flavors and everything like that. Not much more I can say about it than that. I really wanted to enjoy the book. You know how much of a sci-fi nerd I am. You know how much I like my cyberpunk.
You are.
I really wanted to enjoy this book, but I had to fight the language, the jargon, all the way through, and it just made it so that I couldn't enjoy it. No matter how good the concepts are, no matter how good the underlying story is, I just could not enjoy it because I was fighting against the language too much.
Okay.
Moving on.
Yes, on to me. I've been reading New Pompeii by Daniel Godfrey, published by Titan Books.
Yes.
So New Pompeii, it's one of those sci-fi books. It's set sort of 20 minutes into the future.
Yes.
Everything's basically the same, but something's a little different. And there was a company called Novus Particles. Basically, it started off as a way to fix the energy crisis, is they can bring resources from the past forward in time.
Okay.
And they've now started experimenting with that. And they have brought the entire town of Pompeii, kind of from the moment of their destruction forward into the present.
Okay, that's not going to cause complications at all.
No, not at all. So yeah, so this follows Nick Horton, who is basically the son of a disgraced academic who's kind of had trouble making a career of himself, and he gets hired to be the historical advisor.
Sorry, his name's Horton, is he?
Well, it's like H-O-U-G-H-T-O-N.
Oh, so yeah. Houghton.
Yeah, Houghton. Yeah. Houghton. But whatevs.
Sorry, when you said Horton, I was going to make that joke, but I'm not going to now.
So Nick Houghton.
Yes.
He gets hired to be the historical advisor because they've got New Pompeii set up in the middle of like a desert somewhere. And they're basically, they've been lying to the residents saying, yeah, it's just everything looks different because the volcano did so much damage to the surrounding land. And we've been sent by the Emperor Tiberius to help you out.
Okay.
And kind of while he's there, he discovers that Novus Particles, surprise, surprise, they're a bit dodgy because they're a major corporation in a sci-fi novel. So of course they are.
Yes.
And he's basically stuck there while disagreements between the residents and the Novus Particle employees boil over to a head.
Okay.
Yes, I think I like this is like a proper old school sci-fi novel where it's all the focus is on the concept.
Yeah.
And they've really got it fleshed out, this idea that they can only reach back a minimum of like 30 years.
Yeah.
Because anything closer than that, it's like harder to isolate the specific particle you want to bring forward to a limit of about 5,000 years.
Okay.
And, you know, they said that they can only bring people back who have, you know, like kind of at the brink of death.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, it risks causing a paradox.
Yeah.
Except, surprise, they did bring back someone who wasn't on the brink of death.
Oh.
Because that's kind of the subplot is there was a woman called Kirsten who was kind of bouncing about forward in time.
Yeah.
Because she got pulled at the last... Yeah, she was in the bath when she got pulled forward for initially mysterious reasons, which I don't really get why it's that mysterious because the explanation isn't that shocking.
Okay.
Basically, she saved the founder of Novus Particles from choking on a peanut once, but now he wants her out of the way so that no one knows who she is. So that his enemies can't, you know, take her from the time stream before she saves him.
I see.
Again, that's another interesting idea.
It's a bit Looper when you get right down to it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit like Looper. Especially towards the end where, like, it throws in a bit about kind of alternate timelines and stuff.
Yeah. And I like the idea that they only take people who are at the point of death because they're trying to minimize the chance of any paradox. And, you know, at the point of death means they're effectively dead.
Yeah, well, I think the thought that kind of runs through the book that gets repeated a lot is the idea of, would you go back in time to kill Hitler?
Mm.
With, at the end, the rejoinder being, but if you lived in a world where someone went back in time and killed Hitler, how do you know you're not, someone hasn't already gone back in time and saved him?
Yeah.
And that's the universe you're living in.
Yeah.
And that kind of becomes prescient towards the end.
Ah.
Yeah, I like it. I like that it's got like actual well thought out time travel.
See, that's what I like. Why couldn't I have that book?
Shit, I mean, it's not perfect.
Yeah.
Like, I say it's like old school sci-fi, and it is like old school sci-fi also in the fact that there's not much fleshed out beyond the concept.
Yeah.
Like, Nick, he's barely a character. He's more just there to see things so that the reader can know they have happened.
I see.
I think my main complaint is, though, I wouldn't say hard to read.
Yeah.
But it can be a bit irritating in how it kind of flips between him and Kirsten, the woman who's kind of moving through time. Because the chapters are very short. This book is 460-odd pages long. And do you want to know how many chapters it has?
How many?
77.
Really?
Yeah, literally you have like 3 pages long as a chapter.
That's not a chapter.
No, it's not. And I'm not a fan of that.
Okay.
Especially like at the beginning, it feels really disjointed.
Could you not just put a break there instead of a chapter?
Yeah, and like sometimes there is a longer chapter where there'll be a break.
Mm.
Like, I don't understand Daniel Godfrey. Just give me more sizable chapters.
I agree. That's the thing I didn't have a problem with Escapology. Chapter length was reasonable.
Were they nice and long?
Well, they weren't long, but they were reasonable.
Yeah, but long enough is what I meant. I'm very disappointed, though, by one line in this, because what I liked, sort of the metaphor of how the people in Pompeii, kind of, they're showing signs of an uprising, but the people in charge aren't noticing it, and it's going to get to the point where everything explodes and there's nothing they can do to stop it. But then, like, there's literally a line where he says, the people of the town are about ready to erupt. Get it? Because it's like the volcano erupting. See, I enjoyed the metaphor until that point.
Yeah. Hmm.
But yeah, don't have that much more to say about the book.
Enjoyable?
Yeah, it's enjoyable. It's an interesting concept. It's just everything around it is a bit bare bones.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of The Saga of Exiles by Julian Mayer. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I don't think I am.
It reminds me a little bit about that, but kind of in reverse. See, in The Saga of Exiles, you've basically got a future where humans have discovered the ability to travel backwards in time. They can't travel forwards in time, right? Because the future hasn't happened yet. And because the future is unpredictable, they can't actually travel forward in time. But they can travel backwards. And there are people who have had enough of the futuristic world and just want to leave. And now they have the opportunity to go so far back in time, they won't actually impact. They've worked it out so that the whole grandfather paradox, everything like that, has a finite limit. It's not an infinite thing. So if you go back beyond that point, right, basically to a point where humans hadn't actually evolved yet, then you basically negate the effects of the grandfather paradox. It's not a case of if you step on an ant, then you may not be born. You know, it's basically a case of, well, you know, you can step on as many ants as you want. It's not going to have a big effect on the great scheme of things.
Yeah, see, this actually does a similar thing of saying that, see, the timeline is actually fairly resilient.
Yeah. But in this one, in The Saga of Exiles, you have people going back in time. And they basically go back in time and end up on Earth, kind of a prehistoric Earth. And you have these creatures already there. An alien race is already there. And they've been experimenting with a group of primates, proto-humans, effectively.
Yeah.
That's what the exiles find when they end up there. And one of the exiles is basically he's called the most evil man in the world. He is a psychic of Jean Grey levels, psychic ability, Jean Grey, Charles Xavier levels.
Wait, so like they have superpowers and stuff?
Yes, they do.
Oh my God, this is like the comic Exiles.
And, well, I wouldn't be surprised if Exiles took some cues from The Saga of Exiles.
Maybe.
Because the first book, I think, is called The Many-Coloured Land, talking about just the land that they end up in. The aliens are basically doing some doctoring to the genetics of this primate group, and humans turn up. The aliens and the humans realise that they've got something in common, which is superior mental abilities. And by that, I mean psychic abilities, stuff like that. And it goes on from there. And it introduces this whole idea of time travel, but also human evolution, and also psychic abilities. And it gives rise to this thing, which I really liked. There's a famous couple that they refer to in the series. One of them is a woman called Diamond Mask, who is one of the most powerful psychics to have ever been born on Earth, or in one of the Earth colonies. The other one is actually her husband, and even more powerful than her. And his name is Jack the Bodiless. He's basically just a mind.
He is the floating glass cloud.
Yeah, he's basically just like a floating brain kind of thing. That's why he's called Jack the Bodiless.
I promise you say that, but now all I have is like the image of everyone down the pub saying, so, Susie going to the party. No, don't you know she's got nobody to go with? And then they get drunk.
Yes.
I want to read that book.
Yeah. The interesting thing about The Saga of Exiles was that it had this whole galactic milieu, which is kind of a meeting of minds from various races across the galaxy, across the universe, in one kind of cosmic United Nations type thing.
That does not sound like this book in the slightest.
I'm talking about the time travel aspect.
Yeah, yeah.
But sounds like that.
We moved off from that.
I know. Saga of Exiles was weird.
But yeah. But you say Saga, because another thing I like about this, like, it's a done-in-one book.
Yeah.
I miss just a nice done-in-one story.
Yeah, this one, Escapology, I think has a sequel coming out called Virology.
Because everything needs to be franchised now.
Yes. That's one of the reasons why I like authors like Giga Rilke, because he's got a couple of books under his belt that are just standalone books. Stuff like Tigana, A Song for Arbonair, and my personal favourite of his standalone books, The Lions of Al-Rasan.
Yes, you've mentioned that. It does sound very good.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. As a historical fiction, it is really good. A Song for Arbonair is interesting as well, just as a standalone book. But then David Eddings did a couple of things like that, and he was more kind of, you know how fantasy, you have like hardcore fantasy, you got hardcore cyberpunk, you got hardcore science fiction, and hardcore science fantasy. But then you've got the fantasy and sci-fi that's more kind of easy listening or easy reading.
Yeah. Like, this is where I definitely put more in the easy reading pile.
Yeah. David Eddings was definitely easy reading when it came to fantasy. Very easy reading, in fact.
Like, there's certainly something to be said for that style of writing. It's just oiling the wheels, letting everything glide along nicely.
The thing is, I actually enjoy David Eddings' work. I enjoyed quite a lot of David Eddings' work because it was so easy to get into and I could actually pick it up and read it. And they're books that I can go back to and read repeatedly and not actually have to work at it. I can sit down and enjoy it just for what it is, a simple story.
That's kind of what New Pompeii is like.
Hmm.
But I think whether people are going to enjoy this kind of depends on why they're reading it.
Okay.
So I think if you are a sci-fi nerd and you're like me and you like concepts,
yeah,
then you're going to find it interesting.
Yeah.
But I have seen like much harsher reviews on the internet, which, I mean, to be fair, rightly so. It's not like a fantastic plot or characters or anything like that. So I guess it depends what you want to read it for.
Okay. That makes sense, yeah. Shall we move on then?
Oh, actually, wait. It's what you find most important is the better way to put it, I think.
See, that's the thing. I like that about the book you're reading, but what I find most important was kind of absent in the one I was reading. I don't mind anti-heroes, right? I quite like anti-heroes. But I also want some kind of demarcation between the lines. I was full of vitriol and earlier on. I clearly stepped over the line with something I said earlier on.
Oh, yeah, there are like not many occasions where I have to say you've gone a bit far.
Yeah, because I'm very aware of where the line is. And I basically make the effort to not step over the line. But I want something like that in the books I'm reading as well. And there are certain lines that, for me, they just acknowledge that they're there. You don't need to hold yourself back, but just acknowledge that they're there. Maybe I'm not explaining this correctly. I think the author should just basically make a nod to it, like, okay, yeah, he knows this is wrong, but he's going to do it anyway. That's all I need. Yeah. That's literally all I need is, yeah, you know, he thinks to himself, this is not right, but I don't really have much of a choice.
In your book, the characters with the bad traits are shoving it right in your face.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, the characters are kind of just off to the side saying, we're here to show you this cool thing.
Yes. It's a shame because Escapology, no matter how good it is, it felt like I was getting teabagged by jargon.
And on that wonderful mental image, let's move on to the world of musicals.
Yes. Anyway. So, yeah, we've got a book about the definitive visual guide to musicals from DK Books.
They're the same who've done the one on the Sherlock Holmes.
The Shakespeare book.
Shakespeare book.
That movie book over there.
And just the general, the literature book.
Yes, which was actually a lot more interesting than people thought. It's definitely a did you know book. But this one, surprisingly enough, both you and I actually really started enjoying it.
Well, into this book.
It's really weird. It's basically the history of musicals. They start off acknowledging the origins of drama and music and dance being combined into one thing by the ancient Greeks. And then they move on to things like vaudeville and the origins of music hall in vaudeville and the origins of the old musical operas, the stuff by Gilbert and Sullivan and stuff like that, and then the rise of the modern musical, West Side Story, that sort of thing. And it goes through this timeline, and it basically has loads of different musicals in there. Doesn't have the Blues Brothers, but does have a lot of other things in there. Even the producers by Mel Brooks.
Yes, yes, it does, which means I can forgive the omission of the Blues Brothers.
Yes. And the strange thing is, because of the pictures and because of some of the information, because they have researched it quite well, and a lot of the information, yes, it's available on the internet, but it just seems quite cold when you're reading it on the internet. But when you've got this book in your hands and you're looking through and you see the pictures and you sit there and you begin to relax into the book and, yeah, and just read it.
It's kind of the attention to detail, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Makes it much more enjoyable to read.
Yeah. And it's a hefty book. You could do some damage to someone with it if they turn around and say, I don't like musicals.
They thought the film wouldn't hurt.
Yes. West Side Story, indeed. So, anyway, what did you think of this overall?
Yeah, I enjoy. I mean, I kind of had a bit of a flick through it. I enjoyed it. There's always something fun about kind of leafing through it and just seeing a film you like pop up. Like,
yeah,
had a nice big section on The Lion King. Like I say, film, like that was the stage musical, see, which is amazing.
See, I was going through this and doing exactly what you were doing. And I think that's actually the best way to do a book like this. This is definitely a coffee table book. But the best thing with these sorts of books is just to flick through. Don't try and read it cover to cover. Just flick through it. When I was going through it, I was like, I've seen that, and I've seen that, and I've seen that. I know I've seen that. I've totally forgot I've actually watched all of these things. But as I'm flicking through that, I'm going, I've seen that, and I've seen that, I've seen that.
Yeah, it's just that bit of the brain that just loves being able to go, oh, I remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, remember what, like, we saw the picture of Bugsy Malone and both our faces lit up.
We didn't even need an explanation. No. We just looked at it and went, yay, we know what that is.
Good old Bugsy Malone.
Yes, because, we're both boxers in the golden ring. And we could have been anything that we wanted to be.
I'm trying very hard not to burst into song.
Yes, I know. I know. It's Bugsy Malone, though. It's, was it Scott Baio, was it?
It was Scott Baio.
In probably his greatest role ever.
Yeah, and Jodie Foster as well.
Jodie Foster was really good in it,
yeah,
but
she was.
Scott Baio as Bugsy Malone was just amazing because everyone just remembers him from like Happy Days, but when he's in Bugsy Malone. The thing is, I don't care if he wasn't in anything else after that. Bugsy Malone was amazing with like the 1920s cars, but they're all pedals. They're all pedal cars.
The cream pie guns.
The cream pie guns were amazing as well.
I don't know if I've mentioned it, but I love Bugsy Malone.
Do you know, I've actually got, right, my two favourite kind of mafia mob comedies. One of them is Bugsy Malone. The other one is called Miracles, The Godfather of Canton, and stars Jackie Chan.
Nice. Jackie Chan is like the only adult I would have allowed to be in Bugsy Malone.
Yeah, because he'd fit right in.
He would.
And that's the weird thing. Those are my two favourite mafia mob comedy type movies.
Happy memories.
Yes.
Although now I'm disappointed I didn't look for Bugsy Malone yesterday.
Oh,
in my horrific DVD binge.
You should watch Miracles, The Godfather of Canton, though, because that's funny.
I might have to. I do love a nice funny Jackie Chan film.
It's always fun. Anyway, I think we're at the end of the show, so...
We are at the end of the show. It's all over now. We hope you've enjoyed the show. The Geek Show is a voluntary organisation, so we do rely on the support of our lovely listeners. If you want to help out, you can check out our website, geekshow.co.uk, and there's a donate link for PayPal, or you can check out our GoFundMe page. But if you would rather have a lovely, lovely item for your money, you can check out the Geek Shop on our website, where we have aforementioned lovely items for you to buy. We have caps and t-shirts and mugs and more things coming in all the time, just as soon as we think of stuff. And if you want to listen to more shows, you can find us on Mixcloud, we're on YouTube, we're on iTunes, we're elsewhere, probably.
Yes.
We're on thegeekshow.co.uk as well, which I did not mention.
Yes, we are.
Kind of is the obvious one.
Yes, yes it is.
And if you want to get in contact to tell me what a fool I am for missing out, like the obvious thing we're on, you can email us either studio@thegeekshow.co.uk or info@thegeekshow.co.uk. And that was the flawless blurb.
Yes. So, we're going to leave you for another week. We'll be back next week with, well, actually, I will be back next week. You will be on holiday.
Yes, I'll be in Cornwall.
Yes, surfing at Nuki.
Yes. I mean, if you want, I can like try shouting really loud and maybe the microphones will pick it up.
No, 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 because we already have your replacement lined up.
Yes, you're replacing me with other Andy.
Yes, we're replacing you with your original. The person that you replaced yes. is now going to replace you for a week.
Here's the Coke Classic to my new Coke.
Yes, yes. I think he's bringing Dave Gorman's new book. I will be getting to grips with book two of Lady Trent.
Ooh, how yes. exciting.
Yes, it is. It's totally exciting. So look forward to that. So we'll see you all next week.
Well, except no, we won't.
I will see you all next week, and I will see you in a fortnight.
Indeed. Thanks for listening.